It's Philosophy Talk.
What's the fact that a sentence like Santa Claus doesn't exist corresponds to?
Truth and other fictions.
What part of the world out there are we talking about?
Aristotle says, to say of what is that it is true.
A sentence or a belief is true when you can break it up into little bits, individual words or individual concepts, and map those individual concepts onto parts of reality. But it's proven really difficult to come up with a theory of this connection between little bits of sentences and little bits of the world. In other words, to give a theory of reference.
Is truth just a compliment we're prepared to say to sentences we like to assert?
It's a nice theory, but is it true?
Our guest is Alexei Burgess from Stanford University.
If you only aspire to believe things that are true to degree one, you're going to miss out on this piece of information about the world.
Truth and other fictions, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm not. I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the bay at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken is a professor of philosophy and I am a retired old fart.
Oh, John. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, truth and other fictions.
Truth and other fictions. Ken, that's a kind of a provocative title. Truth is usually opposed to fiction. So I don't get confused. Let's break it down a little and start with truth and then maybe get back to fiction. Now, truth, that's allegedly a big philosophical problem.
Truth is a huge problem, John. But it sounds like you don't see much of a problem. What's up with that?
Well, because I think Aristotle basically had it right. I mean, he gave a view that's often called the correspondence theory. It just goes like this. To say of what is, that it is, and of what is not, that it is not, is true. That is, your assertion or your belief has to correspond to reality. If I say that this apple is red, what I say is true if the apple has the property of being red. If I say this apple is not red, what I say is true if the apple doesn't have the property of being red. I mean, what more is there to say?
Well, I think there's a lot more to say. First of all, you were talking about what's said or spoken, but look, what about unspoken truth? The truth that nobody ever utters. I mean, for instance, ask yourself, did a dinosaur sleep on this very spot 60 million years ago? I mean, there are a zillion other things like that would be true or false, even if nobody was ever around to talk about it. So truth doesn't have to do with what we say. It has to do with what is.
I don't like where you're headed there. I think you're going to be led towards what I think of as truth with a capital T. Truth as a thing rather than a mere property of assertions and beliefs. On this picture, there's everything that happens in the world. And then, as if that isn't enough, hovering above it is this truth with a capital T. I don't think we need truth with a capital T. I think Aristotle's focus on truth as a property that beliefs and assertions have when they correspond with the way things are is all we need.
Look, I'm not trying to make a brief for truth with a capital T. I'm not quite sure what that is, to tell you the truth. But we clearly need more things than apples and colors in the world. I mean, we need more than objects and their simple properties. Look, there are truths about the law of nature. There are truths about morality. There are truths about God, truths about number. There's truths about all kinds of stuff. I don't think Aristotle tells us what it means for all those truths, the truth about God, to be true. What makes the truth about God true?
Well, Aristotle doesn't have to tell you the truth about all those things to tell you what truth is. But I guess you're right. We need a little more than just apples and their colors. So philosophers tend to talk about facts. The idea is, well, beliefs and assertions are true if they correspond with the facts. The facts can be about an apple, or 10 apples, or God, or energy, or whatever.
Yeah, but see, I think this is all just as bad as the thing you didn't want, truth with a capital T. Because now, in addition to, you know, the apples and the redness, there's the facts. whatever those might be. And then you've got this mysterious, I think it's a mysterious relation of correspondence. What's that? You have to admit, this is way more complicated than that. To say what is true, that it's true. It's way more complicated than Aristotle's original little ditty.
Okay, I'm flexible. Let's back up and kind of reinterpret Aristotle in a different direction. I still think he had it right. Let's forget about facts. I think he was making something an even simpler point. It's true that the apple is red if the apple is red. But equally, it's true that equals mc squared if equals mc squared. To say that something is true is just to say that thing, that end of story.
See, that's really informative. Wow, why didn't I think of that? It doesn't sound like truth is much of anything at all now. I mean, it just sounds like a nothing.
Well, on this interpretation, I think people call Aristotle's theory the deflationary theory. Truth is just a compliment we pay to sentences that we ourselves are prepared to assert.
That sounds simple enough. But you know, let's think about it. As a theory, I don't think it's going to work. In fact, I think it leads to a contradiction. And the Greeks actually were worried about this. Let's say I say, my statement is not true. Take the statement. My statement is not true. Now, let's apply your formula. It's true that my statement is not true if my statement is not true. But look, if my statement is not true, well, it can't also be true. Contradiction.
Well, good for you, Ken. you have remembered the liar's paradox. Now, my attitude towards the liar's paradox is don't say stupid things like my statement is not true. If people were just avoid saying stupid things like that, the theory would be fine.
Oh, so look, now you just want to pretend that we have a coherent theory of truth, even though the truth leads to a contradiction. You know what it really sounds like? It sounds like you don't really believe in truth. You think truth is just a fiction that's sometimes useful, sometimes not.
Well, I guess that brings us full circle to the title of the show, Truth and Other Fictions. So there is a big question, whether there really is something called the truth, or whether it's just a kind of a convenient fiction that we make up because it's convenient to have a word to honor things that we want to say.
Yeah, big question, John. Now, you know, this truth and fiction combination, writers and performers worry about both truth and fiction. So, you know, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to talk to some of those, and she files this report.
The life of architect Frank Lloyd Wright is well documented. But his mysterious former mistress, Mema Borthwick Cheney, left little behind. Frank and Mema ignited an international media scandal when they ran off to Europe, leaving their families. Mema especially was vilified in the newspapers.
But who was she on the inside? That was the big question.
Nancy Horan is a writer living outside Seattle. Her novel, Loving Frank, tells a fictionalized version of Frank and Mema's 7-year affair. Horan says while she was writing the book, she felt like she was living Mema's life.
I was obsessed. Really, the story just grabbed me by the neck and shook me.
Horan examined Mema's profile. She was relatively wealthy. She had 2 children and a master's degree. She was an early feminist, and she left her husband and children for an eccentric genius.
What was she feeling at that moment? What was going on inside of her? And to understand that, I had to bring to her inner life my own inner life as a woman, as a mother, as a wife, as a friend, as a lover, all these things weighed on my interpretation of who Mema was.
Horan says only through fiction was she able to show readers how Mema came to believe that she would better care for her children if she were happy. So she left them.
What I wanted to do was to simply tell the story from her point of view in a way that she would have told the story and really not judge her.
If there's anyone who's had time to reflect on themes of fact, lies, and fiction, it's Mike Daisy.
The truth of the solution to an algebra equation is very different than the truth of the poem.
Daisy is a performer. You may remember hearing about his one-man show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, about labor conditions in Chinese factories that manufacture Apple products. A version tailored for radio aired on This American Life in early 2012.
I'm telling you that in my first 2 hours of my first day at that gate, I met workers who were 14 years old, 13 years old, 12.
It was a great show. The only problem was Daisy had fabricated parts of the story.
Do you really think Apple doesn't know?
When This American Life found out Daisy had lied about his experiences, they retracted the episode. Let's just say Daisy has gotten a lot of criticism for it, and he has apologized.
You know, I built it originally to exist within the theater, and then I found myself telling the story again and again outside the theater. Negotiating that contract is where I fell short.
Daisy maintains, at least when performed on stage, his story is true, regardless of what really happened.
What does it mean to say something didn't happen? I mean, the story is created from NGO reports that go back more than a decade, using the statistics of what people have seen again and again, combined with my own experiences.
So I asked Daisy about the obligation a performer has to the truth or facts. Daisy says he doesn't really believe in either.
For a long time, the question became, how has this theater artist appropriated the tools of journalism? But now that it's been asked and answered, I find myself asking, how has journalism appropriated the tools of my craft, the theater? And I'll tell you, now that I'm examining it, I see theater everywhere in journalism.
Daisy has also added a colophon or statement at the end of his performances. Here's part of our original conversation.
The management wishes to remind you that this is a true story. And like every story being told every day in every medium, all stories are fiction.
So it's sort of like a disclaimer, although I bet you don't like calling it that.
I absolutely do not. It is not a disclaimer. Don't okay. You dare call that to me. It is a claimer.
Okay.
If there's one thing I've repudiated, I've clearly repudiated the title of nonfiction. It's just that at the end of the journey, I've discovered that everyone else should repudiate it too.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
Thank you, Caitlin, for that very interesting piece, thought-provoking. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
And our guest today is also a professor of philosophy at Stanford. He's a co-author of a book called, simply, Truth. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Alexi Burgess.
Okay, Alexi, you're a young philosopher. You could have thought about free will or personal identity. Philosophy, you have the freedom to think about anything you want.
Yeah.
You specialized on truth and truth from an abstract and logical point of view. Why?
I started out thinking about sort of first order metaphysical questions about personal identity and free will, but I guess I found time and again that ultimately the puzzles had something or other to do, or so it seemed to me, with the language that we used to formulate them in the first place. And so I got interested in the way in which language or other representations like belief map on to reality. And that's sort of the province of the literature on truth.
So when philosophers and logicians look at truth, it quickly gets abstract, lots of technicalities involved. But let's step back for a moment. Particularly in the light of what we just heard from Caitlin and this interesting blowhard who wants us to basically erase the distinction between truth and fiction. Seems like we'd lose something if we did that. It seems like truth plays an important role in our language games, in
right.
our discourse. Can you say a little about that before we get into the technicalities?
Yeah. So there are lots of different roles you might think the notion of truth plays in ordinary life. One that I particularly like is that... And I guess this comes out more clearly with the notion of falsity, which is closely related to the notion of truth. These words help sort of inspire argument and debate about different topics. So, you know, you'll notice that politicians rarely come out and say that something is false because it sounds harsh, and it is harsh. It has a sort of normative bite to it. Try it sometime in a conversation calling something false, and you'll see that things get more heated and involved. And, you know, you might think there's a quasi-evolutionary explanation for the emergence of the concept sort of lurking in the background here, insofar as it's good for us to talk to each other and draw on each other's evidence and pool our resources, insofar as two heads are better than one. It might be good to have concepts like truth and falsity that get us to debate each other.
This thing that you said about try calling something false as a philosopher, philosophers often say to other people, well, that's just false. And they get really mad.
They do, don't they?
They get really mad. But, you know, you could, why? Because because it sounds like nothing more than a disapproving growl. So I say false. That just means I don't like it. Or and there's like, who are you not to like what I have to say? So, I mean, this talk about, you know, you could also think of truth as an approving growl. Talk right. about truth as an approving growl. So we've got this approving growl that we call truth and this disapproving growl that we call falsity. What is that all there is to truth and falsity?
Maybe, you know, that sounds sort of like the deflationary idea that John was talking about before. One neat thing about truth is that you can use it to growl favorably about lots of things at once. So if I say everything John says is true, I don't have to go through each of them one by one and grunt.
Well, firstly, you wouldn't say that. Come on.
No, it's true. It's
sounded true to
artificial
me.
Artificial example. I don't know why I brought it up.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We're talking about truth and other fiction with Alexi Burgess from Stanford University.
We know a lot about truth. We know that some truths are self-evident. We know that there isn't enough truth on cable news. We know that truth suffers during political campaigns. We know that truth is stranger than fiction. But what is this thing called truth that we know so much about? Ken could write a song about that.
The nature of truth, along with questions from our audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guest, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Alexi Burgess from Stanford University, and we're talking about truth and other fictions.
Do you have a favorite theory of truth? Are you skeptical that there is even such a thing as truth? Have you had an experience where the truth turned out to be stranger than fiction? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage and telling us the truth about truth as you see it.
So, Alexi, I want to go back to the correspondence theory of truth, because I think that's everybody's starting point.
Right.
You know, we have these beliefs, and there's a world, and our beliefs are true if they match the way the world is, if they correspond to the way the world is. And that would explain why truth is such a good thing, because if your beliefs don't match the way the world is, you're led astray. But if they do, you get
right.
the goodies and all that stuff. But, you know, lots of philosophers actually, these days especially, reject the correspondence theory of truth. How could anybody reject? I mean, I started out a little skeptical in the opening, but how could anybody really deeply reject this simple, intuitive idea?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a really important question. I mean, the short answer is that the correspondence theory of truth doesn't really exist.
Because the world doesn't exist?
No. The world exists, but... the correspondence theorist says that truth is a matter of a statement or a proposition or a belief corresponding to reality. So what's the fact that a sentence like Santa Claus doesn't exist corresponds to? What part of the world out there are we talking about?
Santa Claus doesn't exist?
It turns out, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, so if now start with something simple.
Like okay.
Santa Claus has a white beard.
Right.
Now, if that were true, that would be because Santa Claus stood for somebody, and that person had the property that having a white beard stands for, namely, having a white beard. Now, the sentence doesn't seem to be true.
Right.
Why? Well, because there is someone that doesn't have a white beard? No, because there isn't even someone that Santa Claus stands for. So it's not that the theory can't handle any of our talk about Santa Claus.
Who is the Santa Claus who doesn't exist? I can say Alexi doesn't have a white beard,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know who I'm talking about. If I say Santa Claus doesn't exist, who am I talking about?
So Santa Claus has a white beard has to do two things to be true. It has to pick out someone, and that person has to have a white beard. Now, if it fails to pick out someone, then your question, well, so who is Santa Claus, isn't a valid question.
Yeah.
Because it didn't pick out anyone. And maybe the phrase Santa Claus doesn't exist is just made to register that situation. That doesn't seem like a terrible consequence
well, what about
for a correspondence theory.
What about this? It's true in the Christmas myth that Santa Claus has a white beard. How about that? That's a truth.
Yeah, maybe that works. But then you want an account of what exactly it takes for something to be true according to a story or false according to a story. And you might have problems dealing with inconsistent fictions, like pretty palpably inconsistent time travel stories, say, like Back to the Future.
But I mean, is that really a problem? I mean, it looks like the correspondence theory would say, well, Santa Claus has a white beard is true in the Santa Claus myth. Well, okay, so there's the Santa Claus myth, and it's got the property of asserting that Santa Claus has a white beard. That's probably true.
Okay, still but correspondence. What about, okay, just, okay.
You know, you can't look for correspondence with Santa Claus because he isn't there, but you can look at correspondence at the myth.
Okay, what about...
skeptics.
Okay, I'm going to take my own beliefs. Forget about the Santa Claus myth. Forget about the Sherlock Holmes story. It's true for Ken Taylor that he's the greatest philosopher ever. Right? It's true in the Ken Taylor thought world. Is that truth?
No, presumably not, right? That's just truth according to your deluded worldview, right?
Well, but true, right.
Is it true that you believe it, or is what you believe true?
No, it's true in my deluded worldview, and it's my worldview. So isn't truth just like indexed to particular people's worldview or particular stories or particular myths, and there's no once and for all truth? How about that? There's no once and for all overall truth. There's either truth in the real myth, truth in my myth, truth in Santa Claus myth, truth, you know.
I think you should go back and review your notes for Introduction to Philosophy, where you no doubt tell the freshman that that's baloney. Right?
There's a name for this view.
Relativism.
Yes. And you think relativism is baloney?
Yeah.
Do you think relativism is baloney?
Well, I mean, so global relativism about absolutely everything, does threaten to be self-undermining in the way we were gesturing at. Is the view
self-undermining
true?
Meaning?
It entails its own negation, or it entails that it's false, right? But then you can distinguish global relativism about absolutely everything, for more local varieties of relativism. So you might think that the aesthetic truths, for example, are only true relative to particular people's sensibilities or something like that.
Okay, so I was trying to get you to tell us why we might give up on the correspondence theory of truth.
I know.
I tried to be a relativist, and instead...
How did we get
and
here?
You told me relativism is incoherent. Since relativism is incoherent, since truth isn't relative, it's absolute. If it's absolute, then, you know, aren't we back at the correspondence theory?
So let's be a little bit more precise about what correspondence theory says. I mean, when people try to work out the details, they say that a sentence or a belief is true when you can break it up into little bits, individual words or individual concepts, and map those individual concepts onto parts of reality, in the way that John was sort of gesturing at in examples, like snow is white is true when the word snow picks out some substance, the word white picks out some property, and the substance enjoys the property. But it's proven really difficult to come up with a theory of this connection between little bits of sentences and little bits of the world. In other words, to give a theory of reference. Even in the case of proper names, it's proven quite difficult to give a theory of what that relation amounts to.
Well, I'm not clear why that's necessary, though. For example, there's a widespread agreement on cases. Ken Taylor stands for him. Alexi Burgess stands for you. John Perry stands for me. We seem to have a robust concept of stands for. Now, as long as we understand these terms so that we can go on in the same way, can't we use them in a theory of truth and leave the job of explicating them to another generation of PhDs?
Yeah, I mean, some people are content to just think optimistically about the future of philosophy, but I tend to think if the research program hasn't panned out, that something's going wrong. And all of our failures in giving a precise theory of reference to complement our correspondence theory of truth are indicative of some deeper underlying problem.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about truth and other fictions in front of a live theater, a live audience at the Mars Theater. We've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name's Chance. I'm from Alameda, California.
Hey.
And I wanted to introduce a notion from mathematics. Fuzzy truth or fuzzy logic. So normally we deal with binary truth, and it seems to me that's what we've been mostly dealing with in the conversation.
Yeah.
So if I ask, is Ken tall, in binary truth, we have to answer yes or no, and that's problematic. Is Ken tall in the context of human men, let's say? But in fuzzy truth, the answer lies somewhere between 0 and 1. And that's infinite. The answer is something like 0.0 3, 1, 0, 6, 5.
So you're talking about degrees of truth, and there's a big question about whether or not we can make sense of the notion of a degree of truth. We have very precise, non-fuzzy, formal models of degree theoretic approaches to talk of truth and falsity. But you want to give some sort of philosophical motivation for the models, and one motivation has to do with noticing that some adjectives are gradable. They come in degrees. So you can say that Ken is taller or shorter than John and make comparisons of that nature. So you might think that sentences like Ken is tall or John is tall have degrees of truth corresponding to the degrees to which the people involved in the sentences have the properties involved in the sentences. But then you have all sorts of technical difficulties that, you know, people have spent a lot of time talking about. But what do you make of the claim that, for example, Ken is taller than John is funny?
So let's try something, Alexei. There's a difference between Ken being sort of tall. So I'm not that tall. I'm sort of tall. There's a difference between Ken being sort of tall and it being sort of true that Ken is
there
tall.
There is, yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, is it tall that comes in degrees, or is it truth that comes in degrees?
Right.
I mean, I'm sort of tall, but that's just true that I'm sort of tall. It's not sort of true that I'm sort of tall, is
right.
it? I mean, my son would like there to be sort of true. I say, did you do that? Did you? Well, I sort of did it.
Right.
You know, I mean.
Well, I mean, just to play a little homage to Lofty Zeta, the great Berkeley figure that invented fuzzy logic, which you rely on every time you take an elevator these days. This formalism, this theory, really works. I mean, of course, you can have a lot of things that work, but then when you dig into the philosophy, it doesn't work. That's one of the paradoxes of life. But I think actually, as I understand fuzzy logic, it's the concept of sort of true as opposed to just the natural vagueness of ordinary concepts. But maybe this is something you know more about?
So no, but I want to press Alexei. I mean, can we give up on just true false and live with sort of true, sort of false? I mean, what's your view? Can we live with this sort of true? I mean, Frege said truth is the thing we should care about. Should we revise that to we should care about being sort of true?
Well, so I think it's important to appreciate that the degrees of truth picture doesn't get rid of absolute truth and absolute falsity. It identifies absolute truth and absolute falsity with poles on this continuum, which you can model, if you like, as the real numbers between 0 and 1. So
okay.
1 is absolute truth.
Okay, so what should I seek? Absolute truth, or should I be satisfied with sort of truth?
If I'm pretending to have the degree theoretic view about truth?
What should I seek?
So the problems of vagueness give you some reason to think that truth degree 1 is not always what you should aspire to. So if you're a borderline case of tallness, say, then the claim that you're tall might only be true to degree 0.75, in which case, if you only aspire to believe things that are true to degree 1, you're going to miss out on this piece of information about the world, which is that Ken Taylor Ken Taylor is tall is true to degree 0.75 or whatever it was.
I'm true to degree 1. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Jason. I live in Oakland.
Hey.
I guess regarding, you know, kind of binary truth, like things just being true or false, how can such a view address things like, you know, probability, right? Like, especially if we don't think that the future is already determined or is already existing in the same way the present and past do. Like, if I say the statement, I will, when I flip this coin, I will get heads, right? I mean, it seems like we can say, well, that's a 50-50 chance, right? But what does that really mean in terms of true? Is it true what I said, that I will get heads? Is it false? Is it somewhere in between, like the fuzzy logic? I mean, it seems kind of incomprehensible, right?
Yeah, I mean, one possible view is that the future doesn't exist yet, so that, strictly speaking, what you said is false. Another possible view is that the claim that you'll get heads is true to degree 50%, so that would be the degree theoretic approach that you just mentioned. An even sort of wackier view is due to John McFarlane here at Berkeley and other people who think that truth is relative in some sense to our interests and our sort of circumstances of evaluation. So the truth value of the claim, I'll get heads, might change over time as the future unfolds.
So what do you believe?
My view is in this case is actually fairly straightforward. My view is that the only facts of the matter in the given domain, the domain of probabilistic discourse, are probabilistic facts. So it's true that the coin will come up heads.
So there's absolute truth about probability.
Right. There's absolute truth about probability.
Let's take one last question before the break. Welcome to Philosophy.
Hi, I'm Sasha, and I'm short. So I want to break a core axiom and bring emotion into this, because I feel like the criteria is usually, of course, reason and logic, but I think that there's a kind of a schism between the truth and belief, and a lot of it has to do with emotion, because I could know something is not true, but if on some way it sinks in and I believe it and it starts to kind of engender that certain sense of belief where someone could say blatantly no, and this is why not, but if I feel it really deeply, I will believe it despite that knowledge and despite having any kind of doubt. And I want to know where it kind of gets lost within that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. So some convenient fictions are so deep that we can't even recognize them as such. We've internalized them and we live by them. I think there are positive practical reasons for having such, say, faith-based beliefs. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but beliefs in the placebo effect can be quite useful, even if in some part of your mind that it's not true.
So let me just sum up before we go to break. I mean, there's truth, which seems to be a binary thing, and a lot of the things that people have been mentioning are that we also have these other ways of assessing beliefs and judgments that aren't binary, including our emotions, and it's not clear how they all fit together. So even if we figure out what truth is, we'd have to figure out how that fits with probability, which seems so much different. And then our emotions, how do they fit on? How are you supposed to feel, how's Othello supposed to feel about Desdemona when he thinks it's a 0.23 likely that she's faithful? Life is a mystery, but we'll solve it in the next segment.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about truth and other fictions with Alexi Burgess from Stanford University.
Is truth just a fiction? Is it one we should get rid of? Or does the concept of truth have some truth to it, some value, some validity?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
By the ghost of something real.
Thanks to our live musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest is Alexi Burgess, co-author of Truth. Alexi, I want to take off on that last question we had before the break about emotion, because it made me think of Nietzsche. Nietzsche talks about the will to truth. Uh-oh. Will to truth is one thing, but truth can be really destructive to human life. You find out there's no God, there's no foundations for morality, you get in despair, and what good is truth? Frege said, seek only the truth. Nietzsche says, seek only the truth. The truth could, like, destroy you. Yeah. He said we have to have the will to illusion, the will to create a world that will sustain our lives. Yeah. I mean, and that goes back to this emotional thing. I mean, what do you think of the idea that, you know, you can't possibly seek only the truth. If you're going to live a human life in a human world, you can't possibly seek the truth as a fetish, as a you know, like Moby Dick kind of thing, an overwhelming.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, the plain fact is that the truth is all often depressing, and sometimes we're better off being blissfully ignorant of it. So, you know, one example that I always come back to is that it seems irrational to vote. It seems as though my vote in the national election literally doesn't make a difference. If I hadn't voted, I did in fact vote, but if I hadn't voted, nothing would have changed. But if everybody recognized this truth, if everybody knew that it was irrational to vote, very bad things would happen.
Well, that's true. But is that an argument? So I'm not quite sure what your take on the Nietzsche. Nietzsche thinks there are, you know, the will to truth can destroy life.
Right.
He calls the will to truth can be overdone. He doesn't want you to just be a liar to yourself, but you got to combine this will to truth with a will to life, as it were, and you got to have what he calls honest illusions somehow.
Yeah.
So we have to create worlds that aren't true, but, you know, in which we can live, kind of thing. So forget the Fregean idea. Forget the rationalist idea that the truth is the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds really nice to me. And in fact, you know, my attitude toward ordinary truth talk is something like this fictionalist view, according to which, though the notion of truth is in some sense incoherent in a way that's pointed up by the logical paradoxes of truth, we ought to keep it around as a kind of convenient fiction for certain purposes that we've talked about.
I mean, if you can take a concept and you can say, look, here's a range of cases to which it clearly applies unproblematically. So we say apples and oranges right. and their colors. And then we can extend it to a lot of other things. And we can show that it projects onto other things so that people who know the truth are more likely to do well in the stock market than people who don't and so forth and so on. And we get a big body of stuff that coheres together, projects onto other things. Then the fact that there are these outlying cases that we don't know quite how to avoid, like the paradox,
right.
is that really an argument that the concept is incoherent? I mean, there are paradoxes in quantum theory. The Pythagoreans thought there were terrible paradoxes in number theory. But if you've got something that applies in so many clear cases in such a clear way, it doesn't seem to me it seems to be untrue to say that it's incoherent as opposed to say incompletely understood or maybe needs to be bounded or circumscribed in some way.
Yeah, no, so there's a lot going on in your question. One thing is that, you know, Zeno's paradox, for example, isn't a genuine paradox. It has a solution. But mm-hmm. what's, I think, special about the truth theoretic paradoxes is that we've been trying just as long and just as hard to solve them, but any attempt to give a solution to the paradox just gives rise to a new, super strengthened version of the paradox.
Is that true of Tarski's theory?
Yeah. Well, Tarski basically...
You guys are getting technical here.
We are, yeah.
Tarski had a theory that went piggyback on modern logic, and it avoided the truth paradox, but only as long as you didn't apply truth to sentences in the same language in which the word truth appeared.
Yeah.
Now, some people don't like that because they don't think it reflects ordinary language, but I don't know that that matters very much. We don't expect number theory to obey ordinary language. So why can't we just all be Tarskians and relax?
I mean, I think for certain purposes, like talking about truth and mathematics, Tarski's construction is very useful. But he did change the subject. He explicitly acknowledged that he changed the subject. He was giving us a coherent surrogate for our ordinary notion of truth because he thought our ordinary notion of truth was defective.
And nobody's actually shown that our ordinary truth is not defective in these logical approaches. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thanks. My name is Stephen, and I'm from Berkeley. I think that what is so simplistic about the correspondence theory of truth is that it makes this assumption that the world is simply discrete substances with categorizable qualities.
Right.
And if we just label everything correctly and put everything in the right bucket, we put ducks in a bucket marked ducks, apples in a bucket marked ducket, then that's all truth is. And I think that a scientific approach to truth, the way it works is it limits the scope of what language is trying to do so it can do it effectively. I think a more rich notion of truth, which I think is more existential, is that truth has, you know, if you think of the world as just substances, that's kind of simple. But if you think the world is human desire and struggles to make desire meaningful over time and to share that struggling meaningful desire with people that we love, and truth becomes a question of, do I really love who I love? And do the people who really love me, do they really love me?
Sounds like there's some subtext here.
And what does that mean? 99% subtext, 1% text.
But I think there's a complicated question, but I want to present out some things, because I think that's a very postmodern view that we just heard in the following sense. So this truth as correspondence does presuppose something. There is a way the world is that's independent of us.
Right.
And we have these representations, and we're trying to match them up to the way the world is. The world is as it is, right? And we're trying to match our representations up to the way the world is. You might think, and some people do think, well, there's lots of things you could think. Well, how could we ever get outside of our representations and say, okay, here are the representations over here, and here's the world over there, and now look, they really match up. And lots of people say you can't do that. Some other people think, well, you know, this idea that there's a world that's just like out there already configured? No, in perceiving the world and conceptualizing the world, we're configuring the world. That's right. Kind of the Nietzschean thought. We're configuring the world, and how should we configure the world in a way that enables us to go on in it, and in a way that sustains our being in it? I mean, that's the kind of thought our questioner was having, I think. Do you think there's anything to this thought, or not?
I think there are all sorts of facts about the world that wouldn't have been facts were it not for the existence of human creatures. So, for example, if we hadn't been around, we would never have made chairs. That's a mundane example of something that's a socially constructed entity. But I also believe in the natural world. I think lots of things would have remained the case even if we had never been around.
So you think there's a mind-independent way the world is. And so another way of going back to this, chopping our sentences up, right, to match little bits of the world, it's as if the world is already chopped up
right
into this and that and the other thing, and then we have to chop our sentences up in a way that matches the way the world's chopped up already. But maybe there's no saying how the world is chopped up, right? I mean, we chop up our representations, the pragmatist would say. We chop up our representations into little bits, and some of the chopping turns out to be useful and some of it's not. And whether the world's already chopped up like that, who knows?
Yeah. And there is an idea that I like implicit in the comment that we just heard, that talk about correspondence and sort of mapping between linguistic or cognitive structures and parts of reality presupposes, it seems, that reality is organized in the same way that language is, which seems like a pretty weird thing to impose upon the natural world.
Well, I want to defend the correspondence theory against the last questioner and both of you guys.
All right.
Because I think this is baloney.
I knew you would. I'm trying to provoke you, John.
The correspondence theory says, look, you've got language, and language comes with subjects and predicates, and maybe there's some subtle questions about how it breaks up, but you know, there's a lot of agreement on that. And a sentence is true if the thing stands for has the property that the predicate stands for. And somebody says, well, that presupposes that the world is divided into orderly categories. No, it doesn't. It just predicts that to the extent that there's not a clear match between the meaning of the predicate and the way the world is organized, you're going to have difficulties applying the concept of truth, which we do. You know, it's fine to say the apple is red, but what if we say this is a chair? No, it's not a chair at a table. Well, what if actually this is what we were using to sit on? Would that make it a chair? Well, it would be unclear whether it was a chair or not, and the statement that it was a chair would also be unclear whether it was true or false. So the correspondence theory gives us the right prediction. It doesn't say that we're not part of the world or that the world chops up eagerly. And as to this idea that somehow our concept of truth is incoherent, I don't think Tarski showed that at all. He may have said it, but he didn't show it. I mean, you might as well say that our concepts of physical space are incoherent because we had a slightly confused notion of weight as both an intrinsic property and as a property that changed as somebody went up a mountain. So they gave us the notion of mass, which corrected that. So maybe Tarski's notion of truth corrects for this flaw. But that doesn't mean that the thing is incoherent, or that we ought to give it up, or say that it's a fiction.
Oh, well, yeah. I let's try this, though. Okay, let's try this. Here's your take.
You guys are getting a lot off your chest.
Here's your take on how the world is.
What you guys said is false.
Here's your take on how the world is. Here's Alexi's take on how the world is. Here's my take on how the world is. Here's his take on how the world is. And they're all competing. And when I say my take is true, all I'm saying is, I like my take. I really like my take. And when you're saying your what you say is true, all you're really saying is, I like it. I like it. And there's no getting beyond the approving grunt to
don't think that theory explains the first thing we say about truth, which is that we seek it. We think that beliefs being true is a good fact. People pay
enormous...
Why does
that have to be part of a theory of truth? Why can't that be an additional fact? Added on after the fact.
Keep going. Yes.
That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, say, truth is an approving grunt. And by the way, it's an approving grunt that people pay an enormous amount of money for in places like the stock market and business because they want to know what's true. That's just an additional fact about truth. I think that's a fact that cries out for explanation. The correspondence theory suggests what the explanation is. Because your interactions with the world don't depend on grunts about your sentences. They depend on how the world is. So you're looking at sentences that tell you how the world is, and the grunts come along as a way of signaling that they have that interesting property.
Oh, say, I'm going to give you 2 minutes, or we're going to take the last 2 minutes, and you're going to convince us of the truth about truth.
Oh, my God.
So what's your best case for your view of the truth about truth?
All you have to convince people of is that I'm wrong, and that usually doesn't take 2 minutes.
Okay.
Well, so just to respond to what John just said, it's obviously right that some people are interested in figuring out the truth about the stock market, but the sort of non-correspondence theorist, the deflationary theorist, as we were calling him, thinks that he can account for that fact by other means, by not relying on premises about the nature of truth, because the deflationist thinks there isn't much to say about the nature of truth. So this guy is going to use this equivalence between saying that snow is white, for example, and saying that snow is white is true, to paraphrase truth out of the thing that you think that people are interested in getting at about the stock market, right? So he's going to say something like, if the stock market went up this amount, then we want to know that happened, right? I can say all that without invoking the notion of truth. So it might be that the norms we're guiding ourselves with don't actually have much to do with the representational relations that do or don't obtain between sentences on the one hand and parts of the world on the other.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm Kelvin from San Francisco. We've talked a lot about truth as kind of a fiction, and how a lot of theories, like correspondence theory, don't map out perfectly onto the world. So it's really a fiction kind of truth. But it seems like we get a lot done. There's a lot in science that we do the evidence-based research. It's fallibilistic, it's pragmatic, but we're always converging towards some sort of truth, or we're striving for some sort of correspondence that actually helps us do a lot of stuff. So it seems like truth is out there, we're going for it, we just don't have a real knowledge of absolutely that we have it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, one of the main challenges to this sort of anti-correspondence, deflationary theory of truth is whether or not the view has the resources to explain why it is that whatever it is that we human beings get up to when we're doing science experiments has a way of honing in on reality at the end of the day, or so we think. Can a deflationary theory of truth explain that?
I think this is a really important point, because one of the things we're trying to do with our beliefs, one of the things that reason is trying to do with our beliefs, is regulate them by how the world actually is. Right? We're not given automatically how the world actually is, and so we try to reason and experiment in such a way that our beliefs get regulated by how the world is. The correspondence theory seems to be the only theory that tries to explain why that's even a possibility, that we could achieve this regulation by the world of our beliefs through inquiry and all that sort of stuff. Don't you agree with that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think there's a lot of hard work that's going to go into explaining how it is that the human cognitive apparatus gets things right some of the time, but I don't think that story is going to involve revelations about the nature of truth or the nature of rightness. I think that story is going to have more to do with our evolutionary past and isn't going to bring in semantic properties.
Okay, that's a big and deep question about which philosophers disagree, and we're going to end our conversation there. It's been a great conversation, Alexei.
I'm glad we got to the bottom of that. Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Alexei Burgess. He's a professor of philosophy from Stanford University. He's co-author of Truth. Alexei, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So, John, you're a rabid correspondence theorist, aren't you?
Yeah, I basically think the correspondence theory is the truth about truth.
Yeah, it's a powerful idea that many people have been tempted by, but you know what? We'll try to settle this as this conversation continues, which it will on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our Facebook page. You can follow our tweets on Twitter. And you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Carola Kreitmar and Joshua Raul Brody, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Stephanie Weissman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, Elise Sugarman, Amy Kessler, and Merle Kessler.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. The brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.